Welcome to North Shore News and Interviews on Amherst Island Radio. Each week, we keep you updated on newsworthy events, happenings, and conversations that we've had with people in the local community and beyond.
I am Eric Tremblay, and this is North Shore News. Hockey fever is returning to Kingston. The Kingston Frontenacs are set to drop the puck on what promises to be one of the most exciting seasons in recent memories. They face off against the Ottawa 67s this Friday, September 19th, 7:05 start at the Slush Puppy Place for their highly anticipated home opener. After an electrifying playoff run last season that saw the black and gold reach the second round and generate the best playoff crowds in years, the Frontenacs are ready to build on that momentum with a fresh roster that blends veteran leadership with some of the most promising young talent in the Ontario Hockey League. The excitement starts early with the fourth annual home opener tailgate party, proudly presented by Scotiabank and taking place from 5 o'clock to 6:30 right there on the tragically hip way in front of the Slush Puppy Place. Families can enjoy food, drinks, live entertainment before heading inside for what the team is calling an electric night of action. What makes this season special, you might ask? Well, the Frontenacs have assembled an intriguing mix of returning stars and exciting newcomers. Veterans like Jacob Battaglia, Tyler Hopkins, Kieran Durvin, Van Williamson anchor the roster, providing that leadership and experience that drove last season's success. But all eyes will be on the team's impressive rookie class. The crown jewel of Kingston's future is 16-year-old Alex Kuhlemann, selected 9th overall in the 2025 OHL Priority Selection Draft. The 6'3", 170-pound son of former Toronto Maple Leaf and New York Islanders forward Nikolai Kuhlemann brings size, skill, and of course, proper bloodline to the Frontenacs. General Manager Corey Cooper calls him a modern-day two-way forward with a high ceiling who has the framework to be a pro in the future. Joining Kuhlemann is fellow first-round pick Matthew Henderson, selected 17th overall, described as a smooth-skating defender that is calm under pressure and plays tons of big minutes. Between the pipes, 17-year-old goaltender Gavin Betts takes over as the team's number one netminder, fresh off a bronze medal at the Hlinka-Gretzky Cup. Betts is poised for stardom and could be the difference maker in Kingston's quest for playoff success this year. And the rivalry element adds even more spice to Friday's opener, the Ottawa 67s. Of course, they're coming to Kingston to visit the Slush Puppy Place, bringing with them the natural intensity of a regional matchup that promises to showcase the best of OHL hockey right from game one. Head coach Troy Mann returns behind the bench after guiding the team to a 40-25-3 regular season record. And of course, that memorable playoff run from last year. With significant roster turnover following the graduation of key veterans, Mann faces the exciting challenge of integrating this fresh new talent while maintaining the competitive standard that energized the community last spring. For Frontenac fans like you, this represents more than just a hockey game. It's a continuation of a special relationship between you and the team and the community all around it. And the buzz that reached new heights during last season's playoff runs, we want to keep it going. There was certainly an excitement in the air and a buzz all around the city and the region. I'm talking about Napanee, Loyalist Township, Stone Mills. And it came to a fever pitch in the second round with the best playoff crowds in years. So mark your calendar. That's Friday, September 19th, 7:05 start at Slush Puppy Place. Come early for a tailgate party. Stay late to celebrate what could be the start of something truly special for Kingston Frontenacs hockey. Tickets are available now, and the team encourages fans to secure their season membership even to be part of what promises to be a memorable campaign in the black and gold. I am Eric Tremblay, and this is North Shore News.
The Lennox and Addington County OPP Detachment presented their annual report, including data about crime, traffic enforcement, and community well-being. The report noted an increase in violent crimes through 2024 and the creation of a Crime Prevention and Community Support Bureau. The report also highlights the detachment's initiatives and successes from the past year. Inspector David Tovill noted where the department is at and what they're looking forward to in the future.
Highlights are crime, roadway, waterway, and trail safety and our community well-being data and highlights successes from the past year. This 2024 report also is a midway report for the Lenox-Addington OPP 2023 to 2025 action plan and provides updates on our current progress and our action plan commitments. So at the end of 2025, we will be going into our next action report. And what's going to be exciting about this one is this time with having our detachment board in place, we're going to be working with the board who represents our communities to understand what our priorities are in each of the communities. And that will form our action plan for our officers moving forward over the next few years. We'll be able to have those little milestone markers throughout that term to evaluate how we're doing and pivot as needed to ensure we're meeting the needs of our community.
Along with the creation of the Crime Prevention and Community Support Bureau, the detachment's response to an increase in violent crimes includes more training for officers. Tovell explains the training they've implemented.
We've increased the number of officers trained in major case investigations, including human trafficking, intimate partner violence investigations, and investigative interviewing techniques. In courses like the human trafficking investigations, these are new courses over the last few years. Again, it's a new concern in policing that we never really had to worry about a number of years ago, but it's just the reality of society now. And, we've learned that human trafficking goes through all of our communities and often it's within all of our communities. It's important for our officers to understand and recognize those signs for those types of crimes.
Tovell details the importance of training and notes the amount of new young officers on their front line.
During the 2023 to 25 action plan period, our detachment, Lenox-Addington OPP, have increased our capacity for investigative excellence in a number of ways. Training has been key for us in training our people. Our detachment frontline in particular is made up of a lot of new young officers. Probably most of our shifts have less than 4 years policing experience, and probably 80% of that is less than 3 years. We have officers who have been on a year and a half coaching new recruits, and that's just the reality of policing across the country. So it's not unique to the OPP, it's just a reality. And with that then comes a high demand for training. And so that's a big burden to put on our Ontario Police College and our Provincial Police Academy out of OPP headquarters.
Tovell spoke about road safety in the area.
Our officers remain steadfast in their commitment to keeping our roads safe. We're pretty proud to say that our impaired driving enforcement has increased 20% over where it was in 2023. Our speed enforcement's increased 32% over 2023. Our seatbelt enforcement has doubled since 2023, and our distracting driving enforcement has near tripled since 2023. Our fatal motor vehicle collisions were reduced, and I'm pleased to report that year to date, there have been no fatalities. Personal injury collisions and property damage collisions have reduced an additional 14% year to date right now from where they were in 2024 through the efforts of our officers.
Tovell went on to speak about waterways and trails in the area as well.
We've engaged with community stakeholders and regional traffic teams to address a number of specific issues on our roads, waterways, and trails. And during this action plan period, we've committed to a full-time marine program. We've done this for a few years now. And between May to September, the OPP has full-time operators on our waterways throughout Lennox and Addington. In 2024, our operators alone engaged more than 1,300 operators on our waterways, promoting recreational safety with a focus on preventing unnecessary injury or death.
Tovell noted the amount of mental health calls they received over the last year.
We are down in our mental health calls this year. Last year, we had 338 calls year to date. We're at 300 right now, so we are down a bit. But still, 300 calls with regards to mental health. And when we didn't at one time have that social services available, and it was police responding, who weren't trained to deal with providing the assistance to these people. That's in place now.
Tovell detailed some of the new technologies officers are using.
The OPP has invested heavily on our frontline mobile digital technology. Over the last year, year and a half, all of our cruisers now have in-car cameras. They have car cameras not only recording the exterior of the car, but we also have cameras inside the front seat, back seat for when we do have prisoners. All officers now have body-worn cameras that are activated through self-activation or when we activate our emergency lights in the cruisers. Not only do our in-car cameras come on, but our body-worn cameras also. And all that video evidence is captured in cloud-based. Each cruiser has mobile workstations. Each officer has now been issued a mobile cell phone. And the purpose of the cell phone is all the video evidence that's coming from our in-car camera, body-worn camera, and taking audio statements. That's all tethered through the mobile phone. And our officers do a lot of the work in uploading that through that device.
Tovell explained the use of closed-circuit television for officers.
We've also trained our officers in the community, the new community safety outreach system, commonly referred to as the CCTV, so Greater Napanee Area, through grant funding and working with Lennington and Addington OPP, have enhanced their CCTV system in the downtown and the main intersection areas. It was a couple of years ago when I first started as a detachment commander, there were a few cameras in place and they were looking to tear down a building, so they called me just to give me a heads up that infrastructure was going to be torn down. And we were able to stop that and actually take advantage of a grant, a substantial grant from the Ontario government. And the CCTV network we now have in the Greater Napanee area has got AI technology. It's got a capacity for automated license plate recognition and those sorts of things. We've used it for locating missing persons, solving crimes.
Tovell speaks about the connection between communities within the county's detachment board.
And we have representatives from all of our communities. I'm very, very pleased with the relationship that we've established within the board already. So great communication and a lot of great stuff ahead. Chairman Norrie and I attended Ontario Association of Police Service Board meeting in London a couple months ago together, and we were able to talk about a lot of policing issues and community safety issues that we share and the work that we're looking forward to doing in the coming year. So things are working really well there.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News. According to their 2024 annual report, Loyalist Township Emergency Services responded to a total of 542 calls for service in 2024. This included a total of 65 fires, resulting in just over $2 million of loss. Fire Chief Kent Reedman noted an approximate percentage of accident calls that come from the 401.
When I look at the stats from last year, it's about around 100 calls. Were car accidents or motor vehicle collisions, exactly 100 out of our calls. So that accounts for about 18.5% of our calls are car accidents. Out of that, I don't have the specifics on the 401, which I can get, and it's probably a good number to actually keep track of. But I would, just a rough guess, we're going to look at probably at least 75%, give or take, of our calls, of our motor vehicle collisions would be on the 401. So a significant amount. So you're probably looking at last year, give or take 75 calls on the 401.
Councillor Paul Proderick spoke about the time spent on the 401.
The chief and I talked last night and I was really intrigued by how much time is spent on 401 calls. I think people need to realize how much of, our time is spent on the major highway.
Reedman provided council with statistics and general information on a variety of operational and division-specific aspects of their team in 2024. They welcomed Reedman as their new fire chief last year, along with two deputy fire chiefs. Just under 6,500 hours of training were delivered to staff in 2024. They counted a total of 29 more service calls in 2024 than in 2023, representing a 5.35% increase. The Amherst View Station responded to the most calls in 2024, being the primary response area for 225 calls. Reedman spoke about the breakdown of their annual report.
It's based on just the average of the municipality. We could separate the more urban areas out. It does create some significant differences within that reporting structure. It definitely can be done. It was just done as an average over the entire township.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News. Greater Napanee Council decided to defer a decision about selling a piece of land with a former CN rail line on it. Staff will wait to hear from the town's ad hoc committee on trails. In May of 2023, Council held a meeting regarding the land in question and created the ad hoc committee on trails. The trail, previously used by the community for recreation, was recently closed following an increase in use of private property by individuals and motorized vehicles. The public portion of the trail ends soon after crossing Highway 401 and leaves no other option but for users to access non-public land if they wish to continue. The town has since blocked access over the bridge on advice of the ad hoc committee. Working on crossing the 401 is underway, but plans cannot be finalized until the MTO finishes widening the highway. The town is also waiting for clarity from the MTO on exactly how in-town trails will be able to cross Highway 401. Mayor Terry Richardson explained why they decided to defer to the ad hoc committee.
We've employed an ad hoc committee to do this work. They've done a marvelous bunch of work. We have a direction to go in. We should bring them back and have a conversation with them because they're the ones that did all the work on this. And so maybe what we should do is before we change direction, because we did have a direction with a resolution, before we change direction, maybe we should have a chat with them and see what their thoughts are. And then, because let's face it, none of us had worked on this, and we had six very able, competent people that worked on this thing. And I'll tell you, they came up with some solutions that I didn't think were possible. And I just don't think it's fair to the ad hoc committee for us to make a decision this evening without actually consulting with them. I just think we owe it to these six people to come and have a chat with us, because I got to admit, they have done an absolutely marvelous bunch of work on this thing.
The town CAO, Matthew Grant, originally recommended removing the resolution from the town's resolution tracker, but staff did not agree. Grant explains.
Since this report's been published, a number of council members have been kind enough to come forward and let me know that the initial report as written really missed the mark. And they explain the reasons why, and I have to agree with them. And what specifically members of council said to me was, by removing this from the resolution tracker, it doesn't sufficiently remind us of our obligation to the stakeholders that we made. And so for clarity, it was a good deed that was not necessarily well thought out. And council, who did not have any desire to change what we were doing, was kind enough to point that out. So it is my intention with some of the background information and an alternative to consider, to sort of put us back on track there.
Councillor Michael Shank explained why listening to the ad hoc committee's recommendation made the most sense.
We all agreed the ad hoc committee said, we're going to close the railway line. And the town went ahead and we put up barriers, but closed no trespassing on the railway bridge itself. And it's proven in how many reports that we've seen that saying that that railway line ends and doesn't go anywhere. It's just going across behind somebody's property. I always try to put yourself in the other person's position, all right, or the other farmer's position or the other thing. What would you feel? Now, we've already gone through all these public meetings and discussions and everything else, and then we're going to leave it to a new council, and you never know who you're going to get, and they're going to say, oh, by the way, we're going to make this into a walking trail. Now, you've got the county arguing about homelessness. You know, you're going to leave public property behind a multi-million dollar farm, and they're not supposed to be upset. I would lose my mind.
Councillor Angela Hicks explained why deferring to the ad hoc committee was council's best option.
I don't have a crystal ball, but I do not foresee in 50 years any way possible for that rail line. And again, that's already been determined by the ad hoc committee, and council has accepted their recommendations. I don't agree necessarily with putting it up for sale right now, but I think it should be. We can remove the resolution. I like the resolution because it's there and it's a glaring reminder to everyone on this council and future councils that it needs to be dealt with, that there is a project underway. It's just sitting there. It's not doing anything. I don't know what the amount of money would be that we would get for it, but I think good faith to the ratepayers of the town and the ad hoc committee is to just leave it, not sell it right now until we've made further headway with the MTO on getting over or under the 401.
Shank noted potential plans he's seen and the importance of the recommendation of the ad hoc committee.
If the trail was going somewhere and it was not in a dead end, you would have an argument on leaving it open and not having it in a surplus list. Camden Road, when they expand the 401, they will be doing redevelopment on that bridge in a walking or whatever. A couple of designs that I saw was one going north with the old Skidoo Trail, one going possibly over the Camden Road, over that bridge there. But at no time do I believe MTO will go underground right where the railway bridge is at this current time. So therefore, we got a dead-end trail, and we've had some very intelligent people sitting on those committees. And if we say, well, by the way, for the last 3 years that you've been doing this committee, and we're, you know what, we don't agree with you, and you've already given to our public meetings, and you gave our presentation, and we didn't question you there, and now we're going to go ahead and say, ah, we don't want to sell it, when they're saying, hey, guys, we don't need it, well, I don't want to be down that road.
CAO Matthew Grant explained what future talks with the ad hoc committee could look like.
I'm confident that they would be very receptive to, you know, sharing their perspectives that they've already given, and to hearing that we're open to making on the ground progress on, you know, trails within the town. I think in some of the conversations that I've had, is talk is great. But investing in some of the trail stuff that we have on the ground is even better.
Staff confirmed that any discussion on the sale of the lands cannot occur until it has been deemed surplus by council. This procedure would need to be accompanied by public consultation. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News. Landowners in Loyalist Township have already showed interest in a proposal brought forth by Westbridge Renewable Energy for a large-scale solar farm. The proposed project would be located on approximately 800 acres of private land near Switzerville. With a target operation date in May of 2030, the project would be capable of supplying energy to 20,000 homes. According to the township's zoning and official plan policies, Loyalist is recognized as having some of the highest photovoltaic potential in the province. Westbridge Renewable Energy is a Canadian-based developer focused on utility-scale solar photovoltaic projects. They currently have operations in Canada, USA, the UK, and Europe. Director and Executive Chair of Westbridge Renewable Energy, Scott Kelly, explains the components of the project and what the site would look like.
Components would really be the solar PV photovoltaic panels in a rural environment. Quiet, generating solar energy and clean electricity to connect to the grid and supply to the local community and industry. In terms of what it would look like, typically rows of 10-meter solar panels, some very small substations and inverters, and gravel access roads and perimeter fencing. We try to keep a fairly low, as much of a low impact as possible, and protect the local environment as much as possible, and it's very key in our site criteria and our development.
Kelly speaks about the proposed site south of the 401 near Switzerville.
This is subject to change. We're going through quite a bit of environmental and other consultation work, working with the local municipalities and trying to refine and fine-tune this.
Kelly explains how the company chooses an ideal site.
The way we look at projects and the way we would select an ideal site is obviously, is there availability on the local transmission line to add new power? And can we connect to it in an economic way and transfer and transmit the clean energy in an economical and efficient way? We look for non-prime agricultural land where there's very good solar radiance, meaning the ability to generate an excellent amount of energy that makes the project economical, where there's definite landowner interest. We see the landowners as very much as our partners, and where there is municipal and community support, and very much where we're working within the guidelines and the policies of the municipalities and the communities that we are partnering with.
Kelly notes how the company collaborates with the communities they work within.
All of our projects are very much a collaboration with the communities in which we are working with. We spend a lot of time with the municipalities, with the local landowners, working within the regulations and the environment that we're working in. Every project is unique, and we look at ourselves as long-term partners with the community and do our very best to benefit the community in every way we can.
Kelly explains how the company establishes a community benefit fund for communities they work with.
In terms of adding back to the community, it's something we very much take as part of our project. Every project that we build and plan and bring to market includes a small fund that would essentially share some of the revenue and some of the benefit and some of the funding and money that comes from this project with the local municipality.
COO and director with Westbridge Renewable Energy, Margaret McKenna, speaks about the lifespan of the project.
The typical lifespan can be kind of anywhere between 35 and 50 years, depending on whether the panels are replaced and how many times they are replaced during the life of the project. There will be a decommissioning plan. It's required as part of the renewable energy approval process. And we anticipate that there would be coordination and consultation with the Loyalist Planning Department in terms of what that looks like.
Kelly explains the timeline of their proposal and their steps going forward.
We did have a pre-consultation meeting at the end of July. We have met with several landowners. I've met with several of them personally in the last few weeks myself, and we're planning an open house just around the corner on the 25th of August at the Odessa Agricultural Society Fairground to discuss face-to-face with anyone in the community who'd like to attend. And we'll be back in September with much more finalized plans and be coming to the council for some support. And the final submission is October 16th.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News. Greater Napanee is potentially facing legal action from its own county. The town received correspondence from a law firm representing Lennox and Addington demanding that Greater Napanee stop distributing an encampment protocol map that identifies county lands as public property. The county has given the town 7 days as of August 25th before legal action will be taken. Following negative interactions between housed and unhoused individuals, the town looked into several legal opinions on an encampment protocol designed to provide a greater level of predictability in the community. Staff developed the encampment protocol map and it has since been used regularly. Staff noted that in the absence of any formal guidance from housing authorities on how to deal with the increasing level of encampments, they would be reluctant to remove this form of guidance. CAO with the town of Greater Napanee, Matthew Grant, explains the legal action and what started it off for the county.
The legal action is about the town's use of the map, which identifies those public spaces, and the issue of litigation arose after a tent appeared on county property at 97 Thomas Street. The argument is that by identifying public lands on a map that case law has deemed accessible to homeless individuals, we are encouraging people to go there.
Grant explained what happened on the day of the complaint.
We hadn't received any complaints about the map until August 13th of this year. That was the same day a homeless individual set up a tent on county lands at 97 Thomas Street. Bylaw was notified of this issue by a community partner in writing. Bylaw was later called to that site after an employee at the county of Lennox and Addington reportedly told the homeless individual and some outreach workers that they had to leave the property or law enforcement would be contacted. On late, you know, in the day on August 13th, I was contacted by the chief administrative officer of the county of Lennox and Addington, telling me they had concerns about the individual on their property. And they were also concerned that bylaw services at the town of Greater Napanee was directing people to that property. I know that is not true, and I did convey that. And I have seen the documentation that proves that.
Staff's report noted that in 2024, Greater Napanee experienced a surge in encampments, with the majority located on property owned by the town. Case law in other municipalities around the province has established that unhoused individuals have a constitutional right to shelter themselves on public property if there is an insufficient supply of shelter and public housing in the community. Grant speaks about the current housing situations in Napanee.
In Greater Napanee, affordable housing and homelessness programming is the responsibility of the County of Lennox and Addington and Prince Edward and Lennox and Addington Social Services. Case law, provincially and federally, has deemed that people have the constitutional right to shelter themselves on public property if there is not enough shelter or affordable housing within a community. That case law has been tried and tested in Waterloo, in Kingston, and in Hamilton, and is applicable to all public lands. And in the town of Greater Napanee, we do not have any shelters and we do not have enough affordable housing.
Grant spoke about the reasoning behind creating the encampment protocol map.
I will take us back to 2024, when the town was experiencing a very difficult time where there was conflict and even violence with the situation around encampments. And candidly, my perspective is that's because the situation was unpredictable. In 2024, in a bid to make things more predictable, to allow people to have access to their parks, as well as providing spaces, in awareness where individuals could exercise their constitutional rights and minimize negative interaction that we experienced in 2024. We developed a parks bylaw and an encampment protocol.
Bylaw officer with the town of Greater Napanee, Arthur Cook, explained how they use the map in the town.
The map is one of our main communication tools when we are interacting with both the public and members of our in-house community in Greater Napanee. It's a main tool that we include in educational handouts. It exists on the backs of orders that we issue, and we have circulated it to the partner agencies that are also working on this issue alongside the town. It is a tool that is easy to understand, that allows us to be able to show people where in a space and time they actually are. For example, if we were interacting with an individual, the public in Conservation Park, we're actually able to show on the map where we are for that interaction. It's a relatively clear, simple, straightforward way that anybody with any level or degree of education or understanding of Napanee can understand.
Cook went on to explain the map doesn't direct people to certain areas, nor do members of staff.
We use the map as a tool to show what areas are sensitive use areas. So per the bylaw, the red spaces on the map where individuals cannot encamp. And we do not direct anybody to any one particular specific location.
Grant spoke about the feedback they received while creating the map.
We included public property on that particular communications instrument. And we did a series of consultation with stakeholders. In terms of feedback we received specifically from partners at the County of Lenox and Addington and Pellis, the feedback we received from a member of their management team was to remove their phone number from the map that we were using. The rest of the phone numbers from different partner organizations, including our own, remains.
Grant went on to detail the timeline of communications they received from the county.
On the 15th of August, it was indicated to me that the county was engaging legal counsel. Later that day, I received correspondence from a solicitor representing the County of Lenox and Addington asking us to stop distributing the map while they conducted a legal review. On August 25th, our solicitors received a cease and desist order demanding that we no longer distribute the encampment protocol map or and stop doing that within 7 calendar days or face litigation. We have been asked to cease and desist using that map. We've also been asked to remove certain lands from that map.
Grant spoke about the usefulness of the map for town staff.
It's important to note, I think, that the map in and of itself, there's nothing illegal about it. It is a lawful document and a useful document, I would suggest. We did go above and beyond to consult the public and our stakeholders on the issue, including the map. We did reach out to all stakeholders, including leadership of the county and Pellis, on the map specifically a year ago. We created the protocol to deal with encampments and to bring predictability in the absence of a clear and coherent strategy around this issue by housing authorities, and it's working. You know, nobody wants this, but I would suggest we're able to manage this better than in 2024, and we're learning.
In response to the legal action, staff will be sending formal correspondence to the county, encouraging them to create their own bylaw governing encampments on their property. They will also be asking the county to develop, publicly consult on, and deploy a strategy for how encampments can be managed. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News. Loyalist Township Council approved the continuation of the Community Tree Initiative with consideration for expansion. Staff are now looking to bring back a funding proposal for the 2026 operating budget. The program supports climate goals, including the planting of 20,000 trees in Loyalist Township by 2034. The program was originally made possible through a $15,000 community grant. In its first year, grant funding supported the purchase of 125 trees by residents. Trees were valued between $165 and $175, reflecting a discounted rate the township received through bulk purchase. Residents paid $25 per tree, and the grant subsidized the remaining cost of the trees. The follow-up survey showed 100% of respondents recognized the benefits to the community. Most participants expressed interest in participating again, and over 75 residents signed up to be notified of future tree programs. With hopes of expanding the program, staff has recommended increasing the number of trees available each year, dependent on program uptake and success. The recommendation would be 250 trees in 2026. Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend showed his support for continuing the program.
The program is great. I do think it should be expanded. I think it conforms to our strategic plan. That's obvious, particularly with respect to our climate action plan. And I think we should find the means to continue to fund it through our usual budget process, which we do for all of our other items that come under our strategic plan.
Councillor Paul Broderick explained why he thinks the program should go through the budget process rather than a community grant.
By putting it through the budget process, we sort of have a better opportunity to look at our needs and what we can afford at that time.
Councillor Jake Ennis disagreed and explained why he wouldn't be supporting the motion.
I'm not going to support the motion. I think it's the type of thing that should be supported by the community grants policy, and I would like to see what staff would come back with as an option there.
Ultimately, the motion was passed, and the program will be funded through the 2026 operating budget. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News. A new transportation subsidy program could be coming to Lennox and Addington County. County Council voted in favor of supporting a local not-for-profit corporation as they apply for grants to assist low-income individuals and families with greater access to transportation. The corporation's founder, Ronald Yeomans, approached the county looking for a letter of support to accompany grant proposals for a transportation subsidy program. The program would subsidize cab fares with a subsidy of $6 per ride. According to staff's report, the advantage of using a cab is the door-to-door service, which benefits people with disabilities and parents of young children. It would also provide the ability to pre-book rides. The service would be available from 5 a.m. to midnight on weekdays and 5 a.m. to 1 a.m. on weekends. Director of Social Services with Lennox and Addington County, Lynn Chenier, spoke about the need for better transportation options in the area.
Transportation in small rural municipalities is always a challenge. We're quite a large geographic area with a smaller population, so public transportation is always a challenge in terms of ridership and affordability. So a nonprofit corporation is requesting a letter of support from the county. They've previously been to Pelus, and it was supported as well.
Chenier noted the program would start in Greater Napanee with hopes of growing.
Initially, they're looking at Greater Napanee just because they're not sure how successful they're going to be with grants. They're starting small, and hopefully they hope to be able to expand in the future to be the whole county. But at this time, what they're looking at is Napanee. They want to look at what the ridership is, the true cost once it's implemented, and those kinds of things.
On January 9th, 2024, the Deserano Transit Service implemented transit routes serving the Belleville to Greater Napanee corridor with a number of stops within Greater Napanee. The funding for this service expired on March 31st of this year. At that time, Greater Napanee Council decided there would be no extension made to the Deserano Transit Agreement. They decided at that time as well to explore alternate transit options, giving consideration to Greater Napanee's population and geography. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans. This is North Shore News.
This has been North Shore News and Interviews. If you have an idea for a story or want to create stories for this show, consider joining our 100% volunteer team. Contact Amherst Island Radio for more details.